Welcome to Adapt It, the podcast where we explore adaptations of various forms. I'm today's host, Tom, and with me is...
Pat.
And KJ.
Today we will be discussing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from 1964 and its adaptations, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory from 1971, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from 2005. I think all know this story. It's from the Roald Dahl book, a fairly short children's book about a mysterious chocolate factory, and a poor boy, Charlie, gets an unlikely ticket to enter into the chocolate factory, and he goes in with a bunch of fairly greedy and misbehaved children who all are, you know, somewhat mutilated through the course of their adventure, and Charlie at the end doesn't get mutilated, so he gets a chocolate factory. Pretty familiar plot, I think, at this point. The adaptations, though, seem to, at least the first one anyway, has a bit of distance from the original source material. Not tremendously, but it has some distance from the source material. And it's probably more famous than the original book. It became a musical. Its music is somewhat known even today. Gene Wilder, it's one of his more famous roles. But do we think ultimately that Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the film, was successful? Were the characters and narrative captured in the adaptation? Did the adaptation take advantage of the film medium?
Do we know why they chose to go the musical route?
It's sort of inferred in the book. I mean, you get the lyrics to the songs kind of in the book.
That's true. So then, should Peter Jackson have made The Hobbit a musical? Maybe that's what
that was. Didn't he make The Hobbit into a musical?
No. They sing a song or two. But...
Yeah, but no, I'm kidding.
Oh.
why did they make it into a musical?
Right, this is a Mary Poppins.
I have a theory.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, go for it.
I have a theory because I think this is something that the second film is lacking. This is one of the things that bugged me about the second film to some extent, is that there's a definite set, like, I'll put it this way. At least two of the songs strike me as having sort of an important impact. And that's that, A, I never really get in the Tim Burton sense that Charlie really cares about candy that much. Like, I never really get a sense that anybody really cares about candy that much. And I never really get a sense in the Tim Burton film that, like, the factory is really all that amazing. Like, there's nothing... I didn't really get why they cared all. Like, there's nothing really that impressive about it. I mean, it's impressive. It's very visually appealing. But there's not a sense of sort of magic or a sense of whimsy. The book gets to spend a lot of time on that. And this is one of the big things that an adaptation has to do, is that the book gets to spend lots of time telling you how important this factory and the chocolate are to Charlie. And it does it through lots of different things. He sees it every day. He's literally, every time he walks out of his house, he smells chocolate. Like, where he lives is completely imbued with chocolate. And so he's obsessed with it. And he's obsessed with getting his candy bars. There's this real sense of that in the book. And the Tim Burton film doesn't have that. They try to, I think, get there with having him build a model of the factory out of toothpaste caps, which is funny, but it doesn't really give me that sense that he really likes it. You don't really get that. Whereas I think in the Gene Wilder one, the songs actually give that sense. Like, you do get the sense with that song. I think this is ultimately the answer. So I think songs let moments rest and they let them kind of settle in for you and really emphasize a single point for an extended period of time. So that opening song, the Candyman mixes it with love, you do get a sense that, like, candy is important here. That is what is important about this. It's about sugar. It's about candy. It's about childhood. That really gets to settle because you get a whole song on it. And same thing with the Land of Pure Imagination. You get a long sequence where they dwell on one idea, and that idea gets to really get into the audience's head that even if this is a world that you are meant to think is really imaginative, really interesting, and spend some time and enjoy it. The Tim Burton film, for as long as it is, and again, I'm sure we might get into this a little more, the Tim Burton film feels rushed. They don't let it settle. Like, you got to book it from moment to moment to moment. And I think that's why the music actually really works in the first film, because it allows those things to really settle in the audience's mind.
It makes a lot of sense to me. It also seems to function as the moral lesson always with the Oompa Loompa songs, which is, you know, a lot less interesting.
It's very Brechty.
Yeah. I guess so.
Now, how is that for top shelf?
Yeah, that's very top shelf. There's no shelf topper. Yeah, I suppose, yeah, you have that kind of instructive thing going on there. But yeah, I think that's a good point. And the melodies, yeah, the music isn't my favorite, but those melodies are memorable. Like, The Land of Pure Imagination is a fun song to hear. And even The Candyman is, you know, that does, as you're saying, Pat, that does stay with you. It's a fine melody. Unlike Cheer Up Charlie, which is...
I can't sing a single song from the Tim Burton one. Like,
I know the Tim Burton one, the music is horrible.
There's no tune. There's no... Yeah. They're completely forgettable.
Yeah. And they're from, like, different generations. Like, you get a 60s song when the girl goes in down the nut chute. But I couldn't tell you what the melody of it was.
No, but I like the numbers. In other words, I liked the Oompa Loompas. It was a little weird because they're all doing the same thing. You know, it was kind of obvious that it was just a replicated thing.
Apparently it wasn't. They apparently filmed each one of them individually.
Individually?
Order to get an individual performance out of them,
wow.
Which definitely registered, right?
but I did actually like the songs in the Tim Burton one. But they're not memorable. They're not. It wasn't a musical. You wouldn't take those songs and put them on stage. Whereas they have taken the ones from the 71 movie and put them on stage. So even though there's music in it, it's not. The songs are there as kind of fun little gimmicks, not to move the plot along, tell us how we're supposed to feel right now, tell us how the characters are feeling right now. That's not what the songs in the Tim Burton one are doing.
What are they doing then?
I think he just wanted, like, short music videos in the middle of his movie, right? Everybody was going to expect Oompa Loompa songs, so he's going to do, like you're saying, from each decade. Mm-hmm. He's going to, what if we do the one that's the 60s one that I thought was pretty funny. I really like the Blueberry one. It's almost like a techno.
Oh, was it a techno? I don't even remember.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
I watched it less than 24 hours ago. I can't remember.
Yeah. And the only reason I remember the 60s one was the outfits. Well, it had nothing to do with the music itself.
Well, I think that's the big thing, is it's more visually appealing. But that is the
05 one.
The 05 one is way more visually appealing. It is a beautiful looking movie. Mm. And I think the numbers are much more striking in that sense. They look much better.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, watching an Oompa Loompa kind of do like a little bit of a barrel roll is not really a particularly impressive choreography.
Yeah,
but it does feel like the 70s, and they have the words coming up on the screen. And
mm-hmm. It is of its time. But I think the art and set direction looks great in the Tim Burton one, for like the house, for example, the slanted house, which, you know, seems like something out of Caligari, right? It that kind of shape to it looks great. And there's moments in it too, like the opening when you first meet Willy Wonka in both versions, in the 71 and 05, there's a sort of element of distrust that's introduced. Like, Wilder apparently purposely, he invented that limp. When Wonka walks out of the factory, he's like limping and people are kind of surprised, and then he does a little roll and everybody applauds. And
he's so proud of himself.
Yeah. Yes. I could do a forward roll. But the idea that Wilder had put forward, why he came up with that and why he wanted to do that, was he wanted people to distrust this guy right from the beginning. Not in a necessarily devious way, but he's not going to be the person you think he is, or he could do something unexpected. And with the Tim Burton film, it was that odd puppet show, and then we have the long camera shot on the puppet as it's burning and its eyes are exploding, and then walking is just next to them clapping, because that's, he could get a better view from there than from his seat.
Which is funny. Actually, I did laugh at that too.
Yeah, I like that. And it's also, it does the same function as the other one, but in a kind of more creepy or more intense way. And I think the 05 version is like the book too, in the sense that I feel like the Gene Wilder one is trying, occasionally reassures Charlie, no one is actually hurt. Don't worry about it. Maybe they'll just have learned a lesson. Well, in the book and in the 05 one, like, yeah, that kid is blue now, or yeah, that kid is 10 feet tall now. And that's, you know, he's a little, it's a little more grim than the 71 version. But I take your point, Pat. It does feel like you're jumping from thing to thing. Yeah, and it doesn't have that sense, like you're saying, it doesn't have that sense that there's anything necessarily important. What's important is that Charlie is kind of a holy angel. You know, he's a very, very good person. He does no wrong, and so on and so forth. And I think that it's nice that they add that moment. This is not in the book either, the moment where Charlie drinks the fizzy water and floats into the air, where you get that, you know, he potentially can do wrong things, or he's not, you know, he's a little more of a character, I think, than in either of the 05 or the book.
Well, I think I think they tried to do this in the 05 one. I just don't think they did it successfully. And I think the 05 script has a little bit of a feeling of written by committee, because I think my gut says what they were trying to do when they adapted it is that it is true in the book, because and you think this is just part of adaptation. I think you can get away with this in a book. The book, essentially, Charlie doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything in the book. He just does it, and that's the whole point. He doesn't do anything wrong, but he doesn't do anything right either.
He's like kind of goes along. Character.
Yeah, he just
goes
along.
He's a way into this world.
Yeah, and that's fine. No one, I finished the book, and even as a kid's book, it feels perfectly satisfying at the end that he gets his factory and everything is good. But I don't think that works in a movie, at least because otherwise it would just have this feeling of essentially being on like a train car and just sort of rolling from scene to scene and then dropping a child off on each way. And then if you got to the end and said, "Congratulations, Charlie, you've won the factory," I don't think anyone would care. So I think what the first movie did, and I think it did it more successfully, was they said, okay, we need some sort of overarching plot, and we need something for Charlie to make a choice. And so in the first movie, the Gene Wilder one, that's the everlasting gobstopper thing. There's a concrete thing that they all are there for. They're all trying to get that everlasting gobstopper. They get it, and Charlie makes the conscious choice at the end to put it on the table, and therefore then he wins the factory. So Charlie actually does, there's something that ties it all together, and Charlie gets to make a choice. I think they tried to do that with the Tim Burton one, but the problem is, which is, this is a big change from the book. And at first I thought, why are they doing this? They add that line to the golden ticket of the, like, and there will be a fabulous prize at the end that some child will win. So right from the get-go, you know there's something more going on, or at least, you know, theoretically the kids know there's something more going on. And I think that's meant to tie it together. The problem is, it makes zero difference. None of the characters behave any differently throughout the movie, the fact that this thing is there. So they've added this element of there being some fabulous prize at the end. And occasionally you get a little sidelong glances from the super competitive Violet to, like, you know, Veruca Salt, or there's some occasionally mention of, like, how do we win the prize? But there's never, no character behaves any differently because of that element being there. It's purely, I can't even call it a MacGuffin, because they don't even seem to care about it. They don't actually pursue it. Mm-hmm. They don't do anything. It has no impact on their actions. But it gives them the chance at the end for Charlie to reject the factory and say, no, I'm going to stay with my family. They had to, like, manufacture that in there to allow him to make a choice. And then, and sort of tack on that sort of coda, which, again, I agree. I think that was one of the better parts of it, is that wisdom of the buildings is gone when he comes back, and, you know, he goes and finds the building later in, like, the North Pole or whatever he is. You know, those were good elements, but they're entirely there so that Charlie can make a conscious choice. But I don't, so I think it works in the first one because it's something concrete and it's something he actually makes the choice on. In the second one, it doesn't do anything. There's no difference. Nobody cares. They don't behave any differently because they know there's some prize that they're supposed to win at the end. They do exactly the same things they would have done anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And they're also trying to link Charlie and Willy in this odd way that, you know, Charlie has to teach Willy Wonka about family, or, you know, something like that. Which also, it's kind of lame. It also sucks the mystery out of Willy Wonka a little bit, which to a certain degree is fine. I, you know, it, it's not it's not necessary that he is absolutely mysterious or completely alien from us. But I think, while I like the Christopher Lee stuff, just because I think that the Flags of the World Museum was funny. And I think also that that was really funny. And I think also the missing house, like, I won't be here when you get back. And like his entire house is gone. It feels like very something that would be in the book. You're surprised it's actually not in the book when you go back and read it. But the consequence of this is now like Charlie teaches Willie about the importance of family or something like that. And, you know, it kind of reduces that character a bit. And the whole movie sort of reduces that character too of Willy Wonka. Do we want to talk about the various performances, the two performances of the main character?
Yes.
Or no,
I mean, we could discuss it. I don't know if there's gonna be much to say.
Yeah,
Johnny Depp ruins the movie with whatever he's trying to
do. Mm-hmm. It's a bad performance. It mm-hmm. just is. Yeah. I mean, some of the lines felt like, I mean, literally some of, especially when they were like, I mean, the very first introduction you have of him when he's like, close the gate, open the gate, like that weird thing. I'm like, what is he doing? Like, this is like, it's, I guess it's alien, but I don't think it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. What is it? What was he doing?
I think he's playing a child. I think it's supposed to, the impression I got of it is, you know, that he, because his childhood was repressed because he couldn't eat candy, that he's like a little boy still, and that he just is like a boy in an adult's body. And there's that one scene, that weird scene where Violet's mother kind of hits on him.
Yeah.
And he like becomes repulsed by it. I mean, it's the one, you know, one little bit of sexuality in any of these material. And you know, that was like, oh, he has the sexual sense that like a 6-year-old would have. That's, he just hasn't developed at all. And I think like the weird high voice and the kind of way of walking, and the fact that he's, I mean, like Gene Wilder's attentive to everybody. It's actually kind of creepy how attentive Gene Wilder is with the people. Like, he'll sit in the boat and like look at each one of them. And Johnny Depp doesn't seem to like notice other people. He's just, it's like he's playing a little boy. And I think that's what the voice was too. A really high up here voice, you know, that's talking like this and that type of thing.
With the little laugh. It was the laugh that.
Yeah. That, yeah. Yeah.
But it was even the weird, it was almost like mugging. It was really, mm-hmm. I don't know what the thing where he couldn't pronounce the word family and he would go, oh. I'm like, yeah. What? What is this? Mm-hmm. Like, I get it. It's a quirky movie and it's meant to have a certain sensibility, but that's just not what a person would do. it just made no sense.
Yeah, I suppose it's like a cartoon character. It like reminds me of like Al Pacino in Scarface, where basically Al Pacino is like, I'm just gonna play a cartoon character. If feels like that, like that's what a cartoon character would do. It would be my
parents. But it goes away too much, and then other times it's like grounded, and then he's very grounded, and he's, you know, I can't understand a word you're saying, you know, you need to, you know, like, and things like that, which are actually kind of funny, but that was fine. But then so some moments seemed perfectly grounded, and some moments you get this sense that like, ah, he's actually calculating things behind the scene, and he's manipulating this whole thing. And then other times you're like, this guy literally seems like he can't like go to the bathroom by himself. Like, you know, I guess to your point, it's like it almost feels like a little kid. You just like, what is this? Like, there's no way to figure out what it is.
The Gene Wilder one is, it's a lot more interesting than I remember it being. It's kind of, it's intense. It's a lot of fun. His line readings are really fun. But you also get the sense with him, like, he's controlling the situation and he knows what he's doing. I don't exactly know why he does everything he does. Like, I don't entirely get the creepy chocolate river boat scene still.
That still scares me.
Yeah, which is intensely creepy. I'm not entirely sure why that character does that to those people, other than they kind of deserve it, most of them. But yeah, still, it's, I had forgotten like how much he's like quoting Shakespeare all the time. And he's quoting these other poets too, Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka, which isn't in the book, right? He doesn't, I don't think he does that at all in the book. Yeah. And so it's just this like, you know, it's this kind of magical guy who's just kind of filled with poetry, and he has a little poetic line or verse for any kind of situation. It's a lot more fun than I remember it. I just remember it as a kid being this kind of like, because it doesn't look great. A lot of the movie just doesn't look great. It has a kind of
It has a 70s aesthetic, yeah.
Yeah, it has a 70s
aesthetic. No, I thought it looked sheen.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't think it looked good, Tom?
It looks pretty cheap.
I think.
Yeah, I thought it looked, yeah, kind of cardboard. And even when they have like the words coming onto the screen and whatnot, screen. Things like that, it really looks of its era.
It's got a little bit of a kind of, you know, a sketch from Laugh-In kind of.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then, and like, you know, mm-hmm. That's a time period, but it's also a sketch comedy show.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah, I don't think it looks particularly great. I think he's the one reason to watch the 70s version. I don't know. What do you think, AJ?
I mean, so I remember in second grade, we read it as a class, and then we watched the movie at the end of the year. And I remember thinking, man, I would love to be in that room with the chocolate river eating the things off the trees.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That TV room was real cool, that how stark white it was. I'm just thinking through the different scenes, and I mean, it's definitely dated, but I don't know. I think it still looks pretty cool. Like, it's definitely someplace I'd like to go.
I think, though, that if you didn't, I think it's also this is where I go back to the songs. I think the songs really help it. I think if you just walked into that room and you were told this was really pretty, and which is sort of what happens in the Tim Burton one, you're told that it's really nice. All the characters are reacting as if it's really nice, but I didn't quite get the sense that that's, I mean, again, it has an aesthetic. I think it's more visually appealing, but I didn't get the sense that it's a place I'd like to be. I didn't get the sense that that room is a place I would like to hang out. But I think if you had the same scene that you get in the same reactions where they're all just sort of reacting to that scene, I don't know if it would work. But with the music, I think you actually, it does actually feel like a place you'd like to be.
Hmm. My problem with the 05 one is everything's CG. So it
supposedly
it
it's
loses
not.
Something.
Supposedly,
a lot of it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Supposedly he tried to do a lot of it with sets.
Okay.
As much as he could. A lot of it is CG, but as much as he could, he supposedly tried to do with sets.
I think the tubes are CG, the tubes that suck up the chocolate. But I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, what was your point, KJ?
Well, so when they walk into the chocolate river room, I don't know how well you guys remember it, there's no ceiling. There's like nothing on the top half of the screen. It's black.
That is,
and the
CG,
bottom half of the screen is the room from the 71 one, but again, it doesn't look like somewhere you want to go. And I'm not saying like, oh, Tim Burton makes things that Tim Burton makes places you want to go, right? We all want to go to the 89 Gotham.
Or want to stay away from, like in Beetlejuice. They're visceral places. They're visceral spaces.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the circus in Big Fish. Like, you want to go to the circus in Big Fish.
Yes.
That circus is great.
And I did not get any of that in the 05 Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm-hmm. None of those places, like when they're in the glass elevator and they're just flying around, I was like, man, I wish I was watching Monsters, Inc. right now. Like every scene just, it felt like if it was practical, but it felt like a CG fest to me that was just assaulting my eyes in a non-artistic way.
Mm-hmm.
The only scene I will say that I did think, although it probably did, it clearly had some CG, the only time I ever thought, oh, that actually looks kind of nice, is the very end of the movie when they show that they've moved the house into the sort of valley thing,
the river valley thing.
And then they have the giant like sugar shakers like dumping
as the snow.
As the snow. I thought, oh, that looks kind of nice. Mm. I looks like a nice little place to.
It's a little cute.
Yeah, spend cute the night. Setup. Yeah, then it looks fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I guess the other comparison I'll make is the boat scenes. So the Gene Wilder one, it's creepy, right? Out of place, terrifying, horrifying. In the 05 one, it fits into the movie well. It's CG, they're in this little boat, but it's also terrifying in a more realistic way. Like if you were on that boat, it was like whitewater rafting without the raft. You were on this pink seahorse thing, right? Being thrown around on these waves.
Yeah.
Like,
but I think I think, though, I don't know. Did you get a sense of fear from that? Like something?
I was thinking if I was going to be on that boat, you really thought you might drown. Whereas if you were in the Gene Wilder one, you would think it was just a Disney ride gone wrong.
Yeah, I think just as an audience member, though, you know, I don't get the sense I'm like in danger on that boat. But the Gene Wilder one, like, I don't know what's happening. Right. That's the thing. As an audience member, it's more unsettling, I think, because it's I don't recognize this. I don't have a leg to stand on in this kind of situation. Well, with the boat ride, it's like we've seen boat rides in movies before. You know what I mean? Like we've had that experience. It's kind of like a bunch of kids are having to watch a chicken get his head cut off, and there's just no explanation for it. Is deeply unsettling. I don't exactly know what it's doing in the movie, but it, yeah. I think that's the difference there. The boat ride is closer to the book. Not that that matters very much.
I think it matters in the sense that this is one of the things that I think is going on with the second book is that it, or the second movie, that it's so focused on getting the details right. Like it wants you to see the different rooms that they passed by on their way to the next thing in the book. Like all of those rooms they go by, even like the hair cream room, are all in the book. And it's almost like it spends so much time trying to get the details right that it has to gloss over other things. You know, it almost feels like we're just like, okay, we've spent enough time in this room. We got to get Augustus in the pipe. Just send him in the river now. Like, come on. We got to move. We all know what's going to happen. Get him going. Now we get to the Oompa Loompa song. Okay, good. Let's go. You know, and then you sort of on to the next thing. And it's almost because it had to spend so much time on all these details that the first film just sort of felt like, yeah, I don't need to get into that. You know, I can, you know, I don't need to show you the hair cream room. That's not a helpful detail.
It's probably an instance where the limitations of what you can do, you probably didn't have the budget for it or the time for it, improve it a lot. It's also an example, I guess, what you're also kind of pointing out, Pat, is it's an example where loyalty just isn't useful. Just being slavishly loyal. Yeah. It's actively damaging. And so I think that goes to kind of our last question, like, did it really move into the new medium well? And the 05 one, you know, not at all, because it just has to carry this entire book with it, except for this, you know, little coda at the end. Well, the sort of winnowing down and kind of dismissal of material that just isn't necessary and not interesting to them, or they couldn't budget, right? They might not be able to afford it, made the 71, you know, much more spirited. And it's interesting, like Tim Burton apparently was pretty vocal about not liking the original one. And I think just because of it, how much it changed from the book, that's the impression I got from the interviews with him. So yeah, I think to a certain degree he was, you know, he was really trying to do whatever he could to circumvent the original one, even though the Chocolate River looks somewhat similar.
That whole world looks the same, with just the you know, contrast slider down a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the reds are a bit more blood red, and the green is a bit more, you know, like a fir tree green. And you know, it's like he was just like, I'm gonna make it more like Game of Thrones and the Godwood. Mm-hmm. You know, like it has that kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I will just say one thing that I think that and again, I think they had to cut this because of budgetary constraints. So they had to change it because of budgetary constraints. I think the squirrels work better than the birds.
Than the geese.
Yeah. The geese. I like that. I think the squirrels are much funnier, and I think the squirrels just work better than the geese laying the golden eggs kind of thing. But I think my gut says in like 1971, they're like, there is no way we're going to make squirrels. Like, that's just going to be really
bad.
Have
to train them.
I mean, even if they were just like, we're going to get like, you know, Jim Henson to make us 100 squirrel puppets, like whatever, my gut says they were like, it's going to be really expensive to make it look good, or it's going to look like, you know, Doctor Who and the Planet of the Squirrels. Like, it's going to look really cheap. So I think they were just like, we got to do something different. I think my gut says they also were like, also, this is more of an American movie, and bad egg works better than bad nut. So I'm guessing they were like, let's just go with eggs. But I do think that the squirrel, I like the squirrels. I just, I, that scene I enjoyed.
They apparently train them. They're actually apparently real squirrels. They train since birth.
Are you actually kidding? Or is
no,
this
I'm
real?
Not. That's what I read, and I doubt it. Incredible.
Gotta be fake. I mean, they did look, if it's not true, they did a very good job with that CGI squirrel. The squirrels did look pretty darn real.
I think the squirrels that beat up the girl at the end were CGI. I think the ones that handling nuts were trained since birth, but
they looked pretty good. I mean, again, that if they were real, I could believe that those were real. I didn't have a problem with those as CGI creations.
Yeah.
KJ, you disagree?
No, I'm realizing how jaded I am. I guess it was 2005. I guess I just assume everything's CG.
At that time, yeah, that's probably the assumption to make. And then again, this is one thing I read, so this might need a secondary source.
And again, I've only read that, yeah, same thing, that he supposedly tried to do as much of it with practical effects and not CGI. But I mean, again, there's clearly CGI in there. Like there's clearly is CGI in there. So this might be the, like, I tried my best to not do CGI. You know, it's like, well, yeah, you just didn't do the whole thing on green screen. You did a lot of it on green screen.
Yeah, the elevator scene is all in green screen. And particularly uninspiring when they're flying through the elevator and seeing all the places. And it's a shame too, because the visuals are, I think, all drawn from Dahl in that scene. The mountain of fudge is from the book.
The weird thing with the receptionist is not, but...
Yes, that's true.
you know what? And the other good joke in there was the hospital for the dolls. A fairly recent...
Fairly
that
recent
that
edition,
made
yes.
me laugh, yeah.
Right? Yes, I did laugh at that.
Yeah.
I had no idea why the doll thing was there at the beginning. It was
the burning dolls.
Dolls. Like,
and why they needed a hospital.
And why he became Vincent Price for a period of time.
I liked the burning dolls, though. I think that worked as an introduction to that world. No?
Yeah. I guess my issue is that too much in that film, it confused weirdness for originality. Like, too often in the 2005 film, it just sort of felt like, well, if we do something really weird, that's unique and original. I'm like, not really. You know, like, it doesn't mean it's good, though. Like, you know, it's the South Park making fun of Family Guy with porpoises kind of thing. Like,
you
can just throw a whole bunch of random things together, but that doesn't necessarily make it good.
I think that scene, though, conveys that you're entering into a space where dangerous things happen.
Yes, fair enough.
Right. Now, that's so I think it did have a purpose in the sense of, like, these people have to be unsettled right away, and we have to be unsettled too. You know, the weird Depp performance following that didn't necessarily, as you're saying, make a lot of sense. It was grounded and not grounded, but I think that that kind of weirdness worked really well for what they were trying. There was a purpose to it, I think. But yeah,
I will agree. Yes, and I did, and I, you know, I'm being a little nitpicky. I did, but I, and I did like the. It's a fairly recent addition. I did like
that. Yeah. All right. So, looking at this, another question: did this adaptation bring the source to more people, or did it reach an audience better than the source? Probably reach an audience better than the source, right? Just because a lot more people see movies, but in terms
but
of...
But you could say that with the first one. I don't think anybody read... I don't think any extra people read the book because of the second one. I don't think the second one keeps it in sort of the conscious, you know, cultural conscience any longer than the first one will.
Well, we had to read the book in second grade. So I'm also wondering, do a lot of people have to read it in school, or was that, you know, our school was an exception?
Oh, I was in second grade with you.
Right.
Wasn't I? I don't remember it.
Yeah. You probably didn't have to read it as well, Tom.
Yeah, we read a bunch of them. There were a lot of the YA books. I think I can't remember what we read for school and what I read on my own at this point. I do not remember reading this book in second grade.
I never, the first book I have a vivid memory of the first book I ever read for school, and it was Johnny Tremaine in fifth grade. That was the first book I ever read for school.
I don't think I've ever read that. I
But I
remember
guess
the
it's just the point, you know, like it was just the fact that it wasn't a book until fifth grade, so that was just
Yeah.
one of these. So like maybe other kids read like something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in seventh grade. I couldn't say.
Well, like we always, you know, the movies are going to reach more people. I just, did the 05 reach a new gen, or had that gen already seen the 71
It
version?
might introduce more people to the 71 version than the book, in the sense of like, don't watch this type thing.
As far as the next generation goes, if the question is, has this introduced people to the next generation? Like, I will at some point show my kids the old, you know, the Gene Wilder Willy Wonka. The only reason I haven't so far is because I think that tunnel scene is terrifying. Like, I really think that would really scare them. So I haven't had them watch it yet. But like, I mean, maybe they'll see the Johnny Depp one at some point on their own or something like that. But it's not a film that I'm gonna be like, okay, guys, now we should sit down and watch this. Like, this is something I want to sit down and watch with you. Like, I will do that with the Hobbit cartoon. I will do that with Lord of the Rings. Like, those are kind of, you know, even like some, you know, Indiana Jones, Star Wars. Like, those are the kind of things where I'm like, okay, guys, this is like an important thing we're gonna have to watch. You know, this is for you to know sort of general culture. And so I will enjoy watching that with them. But, you know, so the Gene Wilder one will probably be one of the movies that we'll watch together at some point. I'm not gonna watch the Johnny Depp one with them. Like, I have no feeling of that
Reason
I
to do
should. Yeah.
it.
And it's not proximity, because the Lord of the Rings films I would happily watch with them, but you know, I would not watch the Gene Wilder.
Do we think the 71 one goes on the shelf with Wizard of Oz, or maybe just the shelf below it, so to say, right? It's not Wizard of Oz, but I think it gets close.
God, I haven't seen Wizard of Oz in so long. In terms of
In terms of stayability, right? They played Wizard
lasting.
of Oz every year on TV, and yeah, last ability. And I think that's what Pat's kind of
Yeah, no,
talking
you're
about,
right.
right?
That is
Yeah.
who I'm
Here's the
talking
movies
to.
I'm gonna
Yeah,
get.
one of those. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I'm not entirely sure, like what a 25-year-old right now would know about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I was gonna ask my students, right, who are like in their 20s.
They do. The only reason I know that some of them do is because I see it on the gram. And maybe this is, and here's the problem. I think I might be old because that is the only social media I have. So maybe it's not. But I do see it on the gram sometimes as an example of like families, you know, family members treating children really badly, and how like older people are like horrible to their children, kind of thing. In the example of Grandpa Joe, and how they're like, this guy, you know, look at these guys, they all just sit in bed all day and they never do anything. And then, you know, when their son finally does something right, that's when they suddenly knock it on the door. Like that. So I've seen it used as an example of
Okay, so
that.
25-year-olds insult each other by calling themselves Grandpa Joe. You're such a grandpa,
No,
Grandpa Joe. Go do
they're
the
mocking their
dishes.
family. Like, they're mocking how like adults treat them. That adults are just like, the boomers. The boomers are just sitting there waiting for
Sitting on
everybody.
the
You know, these are
bed.
these horrible old, you know, like that sort of thing. So
Go make me some cabbage soup.
I've seen it used as something like that. Now, again, that could be more my generation, like late 30s, you know, kind of using that, because I don't know who's on Instagram, but that I at least know that it at least has carried that far. As a definitely recognizable image of those four people sitting in the bed from the 1971 film is definitely recognizable.
People who said, okay.
We went to the middle school play 2 years ago, and it was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I know the play at least is, I don't know, I'll say still in schools, but it's in the circuits.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense because it's. There's a bunch of songs that groups can sing. Not one person is singing all the songs, and the songs aren't that hard to sing. They don't require a huge range. So, and it's pretty short. So, I mean, I think that would go into schools really well. Yeah, so that kind of drops, I think, at like whatever, elementary, middle school, high school. So it could survive in that way. But yeah, I think if people are, like you're saying, Pat, on Insta, if they're still talking about it or using it as a meme or what have you. Yeah, I suppose it has kind of cultural endurance. In a way, yeah, the Johnny Depp one just won't have.
Yeah, I think if you had shown me a picture, I mean, and maybe if you'd shown me the picture from the Johnny Depp one, having not seen it, but I don't know if I would have known what movie it was from, you know, even, but I think most people would know immediately that shot of the four people sitting in the bed from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I think they would know it.
Yeah. And I think they would know Gene Wilder in the top hat.
Yeah.
I think they would recognize that as well, the top hat and the cane. Well, I think you might not even recognize it's Johnny Depp, never mind what character he's playing, if you just saw him. He doesn't look anything like his normal self.
And the thing is, Johnny Depp has done some great performances. I just don't get what he was doing there.
Yeah, I think it's he's done a. That was the time where what Pirates was
Pirates had just
03.
come out. Pirates had just
Yeah.
come out. Yeah, it was 03.
I
Summer of
think it was
03.
03. And like with Pirates, he played this character in a way that the producers told him he shouldn't do, and he just did it anyway. And it that's what made that movie all that money. Now, that movie was not like this brilliant movie. It's everybody went there to
But his
see
performance is great.
him.
His performance is
Yeah.
good. It's a really good performance.
And I think he did Sleepy Hollow either right after that, where he played the main character as a prepubescent girl. Like he's playing Ichabod Crane, but he said, I played the whole thing like a little girl.
It was well before that, though. I think
Was it before
it was
that?
like 99.
Oh, was it that early? Oh
I
my
think it's
God.
much earlier. I think it's much
Yeah.
earlier.
But I mean, I think that movie was also successful. And I think it was just one of these things where he's like, I can do whatever I want and everybody will come and see it. And I think that's he's
But it's
so.
like, you know, I mean, he does, but I guess it's just, why doesn't it work? Because he does, I mean, it's not that dissimilar from, say, Ed Wood, which does have these really strong choices. Hi, Bella, you know, like nifty Bella, but it works in that movie. Why doesn't it work here?
He's because you need, I mean, Gene, because Charlie isn't, I guess Charlie's like the heart of the movie or what, he's the character that's leading us through, but the magic is Willy Wonka, right? Like he's the place. Right. I mean, yes, the place is all the stuff and whatnot that's going on, but the reason why we like the 71 version as much as we do is that like Gene Wilder is the place. He takes that all into himself. The whole place is an expression of him, and his kind of zaniness matches the
Yeah, maybe that's it.
atmosphere.
Yeah.
And with having a like an basically completely alienated little boy in this weird haircut and whatnot, his weirdness isn't it isn't imaginative and inviting. It's just creepy and closed off. And so, you know, he's like this, like he doesn't touch anything. He has these like thick rubber
Yeah.
gloves that are like latex sounding or something like that. They're like surgeon's gloves.
But did you notice at the end his father wears the same gloves?
Oh, I didn't notice.
They were dentist gloves
They
the
were
whole time.
dentist gloves the whole time. Deep. But it's, I mean, I think it speaks to the problem too. Like there's surgical gloves. Like he's just disconnected from everything. And he's not able to connect. He's not able to talk to the children. And so this, like, you don't want to be in the imaginative world of this person because he's like an underdeveloped kind of weird asexual man.
But then they would have to cut your favorite line.
Oh yeah. Would you like to know my name? I can't hardly imagine it matters.
Can't imagine it matters.
Yeah.
It's
I can't
just
imagine it matters.
like, I mean, that is good. That's a good one-liner.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's stuff he does to like, you're mumbling again.
Yeah.
Mumbler, mumbler, you know, like that kind of made me laugh too. I mean, there's these just moments of,
It works in points, yeah.
yeah, there's moments, but I think to your point too, Pat, of like, sometimes it's grounded and sometimes it's just not at all. And so it's not only are the choices alienating, it sometimes just isn't. It isn't a. He's not playing objectives. He's just
He's
doing
mugging. He
voices.
mugs.
Yeah.
He mugs at
No,
points.
you're right. Yeah. No, he's mugging. He's doing faces. And it's, you know, and it's a little weird. And it's not that fun. The Gene Wilder, the one though, is like I didn't realize like that boat scene when they're going into the boat. I know I said this before, but he's sitting in that boat, and there's so much footage of him just sitting there before they get into the actual tunnel, and the weirdness happens, and he's just staring at everyone. He's going from person to person and just staring at them like this.
Tom's staring at Pat. Tom's staring at me.
This was not a good choice for an audio only show. But it's just there's little choices he makes they're kind of the opposite, because they're really grounded. They're clearly, there's an intention he's going for. I'm not entirely sure what it is all the time, but you could see he's pursuing something. But it's as kind of strange as sometimes it is, it also is very inviting, because he's just such a charming man that those little things that might be creepy on somebody else are kind of fascinating. And he seems to be making those choices all the time. I love the Gene Wilder line reading whenever like something bad is about to happen to a kid. And he's like, oh no, stop. Don't come back. Yeah.
I wouldn't do that if I were you. I can't even do it. Be able to do it. Yeah.
Police.
Right. Now, we have not talked about the video game adaptation.
We have not.
We've not. So, did you guys have you played it at all? It's on the ZX Spectrum.
What is the ZX Spectrum?
So, the ZX Spectrum was popular in Europe, I guess, maybe specifically the UK. But it was more of a home computer, somewhere in between a home computer and a home console. And they played a bunch of games on there. In fact, audience, if you're interested in hearing us play through a game on the ZX Spectrum, that's how we played The Hobbit from 1982 in our show Limited Lexicon. But there was a Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory game for the ZX Spectrum, which I tried to play. Did you guys try to play at all, or did you guys check it out?
No, I should have.
I saw some of the screenshots. I mean, it just looks like they put a bunch of mini games together, right?
It was terrible. So ZX Spectrum games, some of them came on cassette. So the front side, or the side A, was 4 mini games. You either could try to help Gustus Gloop get out of a pipe maze. You were Violet trying to dodge blueberries. Mm-hmm. Or you were Veronica Salt trying to feed the squirrels.
Veruca
Salt trying to feed the squirrels. Or you were Mike TV trying to collect Wonka bars. And then the main game, you were Charlie going through single screens, but it was kind of like a Mario game, like a 2D platformer, but it was just so poorly made. You couldn't, it was, the frame rate was like one frame per second. Mm. It was very tough to play.
No.
don't recommend it at all, audience.
So why does Mike TV collect candy bars?
There are only so many things you can do.
But he has a little gun. He walks around with a little Western gun.
Yeah, he could. Yeah.
Do you know how difficult that would have been to program projectiles? Like, that was static candy bars that the sprite walks to are much easier to deal with.
But one interesting thing is Veronica Salt was feeding squirrels, not geese. So this was based on the book. Not the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if they did rights back then for these kind of things, but that was an interesting decision.
It might be a rights thing.
I think maybe we'll do this when we discuss Mario at some point, but I think it would be an interesting discussion because I couldn't think of any. So there are plenty of books that are made into movies, and there are plenty of movies that are made into video games, but how many books are made into video games directly?
Mm. Oh, from the book into the
from
video game?
From the book into a video game.
No, the Hobbit on the spectrum.
Well, again,
spectrum.
Like, but I think this will be a good discussion when we get to Mario.
Mm. Huh. Yeah. Well, the Hobbit was, I mean, there's a few of them, right?
I can think of a few, but are there any? I guess we'll
get into that then.
Get into it. That's a great
question. I think that's a good question to ask for Mario.
Put some of that together.
And why? Why doesn't it work?
I think
there are even examples of movies that have books that have been turned into movies that have been turned into video games, but there's no good examples of books turned directly into video games, or at least there's like
popular video.
I think it's a good question, but there are plenty of books made into movies, and there are even books made into movies made into video games, but it doesn't tend to work directly from books to movies. But I think good question to ask for a later point.
So last question here, do we feel the author's authority in these adaptations?
I think there is more respect, somewhat, for the author's authority in the Johnny Depp one. And I think, again, I think this is something what I mentioned earlier. I think it's to its detriment. I think it tries to pay homage a little bit too much. And so it sort of actually loses some more of the details. It does update some stuff. Like, some stuff you have to change. Like, okay, there aren't two parents for each kid. That's more a choreography problem. Like, you just, you're, you, you know, if you've got 15 people walking around on your screen, it becomes very difficult, I think, to film it. So they cut them. Fine. Only, you know, each kid gets one parent. That's, I don't think anybody would complain about that from an adaptation perspective. But, you know, they update Mike TV. They make him more of, like, you know, this sort of know-it-all kid. Although this, I think, is actually more self-serving. I think they make him a know-it-all kid, you know, rather than make him a hater of TV, because, you know, the studios aren't going to bite their own half of their production. They're not going to go and tell people not to watch TV. But I think that, you know, they update him a little bit and make it more about video games, and he's just a know-it-all, and they take the gum chewer and make her more into the sort of, like, hyper-competitive one. Those aspects aren't in the book at all, but I think they actually work fairly well. I think they get, you know, those are fine updates. So most of the updates tend to be within, within sort of the spirit, and then they tend to just sort of add some extra details here and there. But I think that actually hurts it, because it got just stuck. It would be like, to your example, Tom, when we were talking about Lord of the Rings, where they felt like, well, now I need to explain to you about the nature of this statue head that's in the background. It's like, no, it doesn't. You don't need to do that. That can just be there. And I think that the Gene Wilder one isn't as sort of quote unquote respectful, but I think it's actually makes it a I think it is better adaptation, because it's sort of, it isn't as beholden.
And I think that speaks to the question of authority as sort of the spirit of the original versus the simple plot of the original, the simple narrative, right? Like, can you, if you're capturing the sort of, if you're capturing the spirit of the book by changing it in some kind of substantial way, is that more faithful or more authoritative or more respectful of the author's authority than just being kind of slavishly faithful to the plot as much as you can be? I think most authors would say, no, you got to be slavishly faithful to my plot, because my plot is perfect and I worked it out and I sat down and I outlined it, you know, and that type of thing. But the book, I don't know, what did you guys think of the book? But I thought the book was a fun read. I mean, you skim right through it. It's pretty entertaining. And that kind of sense of whimsy is far more on display. The thing that made the book entertaining, I think, is far more on display in the Gene Wilder. Yes, they change a lot of the plot, but I don't think they change the atmosphere at all. I think it feels the mood seems to be exactly the same in the book and the movie. And it's not that they're changing the mood in the Johnny Depp adaptation, they're just failing to capture any mood whatsoever. And I think that's more of a violation of the author's authority than any particular alteration in the plot.
Can you change things and still keep it? So, can you change things and keep it still in this, if you're trying to just keep it in the spirit of the medium? I think you can, if the change you're making is required by the medium into which you're transitioning. Because, so there's certain things that film can't do that books can do. And an example of that is, like, and this is where I think this is why I think the riverboat thing doesn't work as well in the Johnny Depp one. Because what a book can do fairly quickly is just sort of spit details at you in a way that sort of they move pretty quickly, because I can read through them fairly quickly, but it allows me to sort of get the sense of, oh, this is kind of funny. Like, let me show you this room, you know, and then they'll be like, here's the hair gel room, you know, here's the coffee cream room, here's the hair gel room, you know, and they show those different rooms, and it's sort of pretty quick, you know, and it's, oh, that's kind of funny. But the film can't do that. Films have to, like, show it and establish the shot and then talk about it. And then you think, if you're watching it, being like, oh, this must be an important thing I have to pay attention to, but actually it's not, because it's totally gone within 30 seconds. Like,
Yeah,
films
it's a
can't,
verbal joke.
yeah, and films can't do establishments, shots, and sort of do quick delivery of details like that, because without them either washing over or spending too much time on them. So things like that should be cut. You know, you don't need those. Books do those well. Film doesn't do that well. There is, you know, other things that film does well, and so maybe you can add those things in. Films tend to have more of, like, overarching plots. If they don't, if you just get to the end and Charlie gets handed the factory with absolutely nothing that he's done throughout the film, it will feel pretty hollow. So you have to almost add something in for Charlie to do and make a choice throughout. Otherwise, a film will feel hollow, whereas a book doesn't. So you can make changes if the medium that you're adapting it to requires those changes, if you're just making them for no reason whatsoever, then I think that is sort of a violation of the author's authority. But if you're making them because the medium into which you're adapting them requires them, then it's okay. Or it's not even just okay, you have to do it or you break the thing.
Yeah, and you need a dramatic tension. A book doesn't need a dramatic tension. It could have it, and often they're more fun, but you could have books that are much more about the kind of verbal structure. I mean, we've both read Ulysses. There is not a lot of dramatic tension in that book.
I would say more like To the Lighthouse, because To the Lighthouse is less of a, it's experimental, but nothing, literally nothing
Nothing
happens in To the
happens, yeah.
Lighthouse. And it works as a book. I mean, I'm sure they made a movie of it. I'm sure it's terrible.
They made a movie, Mrs. Dalloway, with oh God, who Vanessa Redgrave. But anyway, yeah, and to your point about like the hair cream, that kind of joke, which actually is in the 71 version, but it's on one door. They just
Oh, I
have all
missed
the
it.
names. Yeah. They don't, like you're saying, they don't do an establishment shot. It's one door. It's like hair cream, blah, 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 blah cream, blah, 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 cream, hair, or whatever, whipped cream, ice cream, hair cream, that type of thing. And if you don't notice it, you miss the joke, which is fine because we don't have to dwell on it. But a book can do those kind of verbal tics and plays, and it could give you interiors of psyches of characters as well in a way that a movie really can, unless it goes exposition heavy, which is always death.
Well, it's like the movie has to spend 30 seconds on the joke about the whipped cream, with the whipping of the cut. Like they had to spend a good 30 seconds. I mean,
Yeah,
percentage wise,
showing you with the.
it's a decent chunk of the film. 30 seconds out of, yeah, it's not that long of a, it's a 2-hour-long movie, but 30 seconds of that has to be spent on just that joke. Whereas in the book, it's two sentences. It's
Then you
a
move on.
significantly smaller percentage of the book. But now it gets blown up to something fairly, relatively speaking, significant that doesn't work.
Yeah, and it's like a pun. Like they're trying to visualize a pun, like this is not it, it doesn't it would be like
Oh,
trying to
Far
vi
Side would disagree with you very
that's true. It's
much.
Gary Larson would is he dead? I was gonna say he's rolling in his grave, but I'm
No,
not
I think
entirely
he's dead. I
sure.
think he started making new cartoons
Oh, did
recently.
he? Oh,
I
good
think
for
so.
him. He'd be rolling in his studio, maybe. But yeah, I mean, it would be like trying to visualize a metaphor. Like somebody does an interesting metaphor, and you just put it on screen. It doesn't work. But at the same time, you need a conflict that somebody has to overcome, right?
Like the snow and the dead.
Yeah, I guess you did visualize that metaphor.
Sorry.
enough. That's okay. It's good. Yeah.
Oh, have
Yeah.
either of you guys seen the new Wonka movie, The Origin Story?
No. There's somebody who was a professor of Pat and myself who Pat and
I'm
me.
seeing him for dinner.
Oh, are you? Oh. Yeah, he gave a pretty scathing review of it.
The first two acts are a musical, and I enjoyed it. The third act is a little bit more like a Saturday morning cartoon, and it kind of falls apart. But just to entice you guys a little bit, the villain are 500 chocoholic monks.
Oh,
That's
so it's
funny.
yeah, I
Yeah,
like that idea.
that's funny. That works.
Kind of want to see it now. If you enjoyed Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and are looking for more adaptations of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, check out the 2013 stage play or the 1985 ZX Spectrum video game. You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Keep Making Movies, where we explore micro-budget films, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, and Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. and may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Adapt It, wherever fine podcasts are found. Join us next time when we discuss Pride and Prejudice and look at the 1995 TV miniseries Pride and Prejudice and the 2005 film.
Wow, Talking Studios.
Next week, we'll be discussing Pride and Prejudice. Pat, what is your favorite adaptation of Pride and Prejudice?
So I will start by saying that next week I will discuss my first experience with Pride and Prejudice, which is different from my favorite one, but it's a much better story. I think the movies are great, but you know, Wishbones, that adaptation of Pride and Prejudice is wonderful. I grew up watching Wishbone. I mean, I say I grew up, I think I was actually too old for the show when I was watching it, but it's still, I still love Wishbone. So I think I'm still going to go with Wishbone. Wishbone's adaptation of Pride and Prejudice is my favorite adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
I just recently learned about Wishbone and saw the Pride and Prejudice Wishbone, and it is top quality. It is a very, very fun thing.
To KJ's point, if you ever want to be perfect, if you ever want to like make it through Jeopardy and make it through the lit categories of Jeopardy, watch all the episodes of Wishbone. You'll be all set.
An audience, so well, just to explain what Wishbone is real quick. So
they know!
Pat sent us a link of one of the episodes of Wishbone, which is a show about a dog. It's a 30-minute PBS show about a dog, but they do classic literature. And just like Pat's saying, it was wonderful. They go through the major plot points of Pride and Prejudice, the dog being Mr. Darcy, who, if you haven't seen it or read it yet, is a major character. And at the same time, they're cutting back to the 90s where the kids are going to a prom or something. It is wonderful. Like, go watch that, audience. But here is what I think my favorite adaptation of Pride and Prejudice would be if it could exist. I'm looking for a Westworld-style amusement park that is Pride and Prejudice. So no violence, no guns, no none of that. But the bots are, maybe they're of society, maybe they're, you know, upper, lower, who knows. And you get to live in these estates. You can travel from estate to state on horseback or in the carriage or walk, whatever you want to do. So I'm picturing a Westworld-style amusement park that you spend a week or so at that is based on Pride and Prejudice.
Can you kill Mrs. Bennet?
No, you cannot. Well, yes, with
Everyone,
your charm and wit.
I am going to be Mrs. Bennet's defender tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Next week.
Well, at the park, you could be Mrs. Bennet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So, yeah, you can't do true Westworld where you could kill anybody. You have
No. Well, so that's the old West.
The
that's not Westworld.
Right. You have to embody the rules and manners of this society.
Exactly. If you want to live your dream out of trying to be Mrs. Bennet and marrying off your kids, mm-hmm. come to the Pride and Prejudice.
You can do
park.
It. There we go. Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah. And yeah, I feel like that park is going to attract a lot of women and very few men, but that's okay.
You never
know. It would be fun. Yeah, it would
Tom,
be fun.
Tom, you are
to
very,
be...
very, very wrong.
How about you, Tom? What's your favorite adaptation?
Oh, God. I think the 05 one is my favorite. We should have watched Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. That was a damn mistake on my part not to suggest that. That looks either wonderful or terrible. I'm not entirely sure which. But I think the 05 one is my favorite, even though. I was my advisor in school is an Austen scholar, and she hates that version. Hates that version. Hates Keira Knightley. Hates the movie. And it's kind of interesting. Like a lot of like Pride people, they remind me sort of the people who are really into Lord of the Rings, who really hate the movies. There's a lot of these like Austen nerds who hate the 05 one. They seem to like the 1995 one for whatever reason, but they hate the 05 one. And that kind of makes me like it more. But so I'm going to say the 05 one. And I think it's kind of fascinating how much these people dislike it.